name of the Sedra. What did Balak do to deserve that a Sedra in the Torah should be named for him? They're very limited people that have names for their names of the Sedra. There's Noach, right, who the Chora deserves a Parsha. Chai Sora, right? Some say that Toldos Avram, Toldos, right, Ehla Toldos Avram is called Toldos Avram, not just Toldos, even though we don't usually call it like that. And then also a lot of Yaakovs, right, Vayeshev Yaakov, Vayetze Yaakov, Vayishlach Yaakov, sometimes is included. So the Avos, at least Sori Menu has a Parsha. And then there's Yisro, right, also has a Parsha, and Pinchas, who also the Chora deserves a Parsha, and Balak. Right? Why Balak? So I think the simplest idea is that from Balak we see the idea, the Gemara learns from Balak, that mito shelo lishma la'olam yasuk adam b'toru mitzvah shelo lishma, shemito shelo lishma balishma. Balak brought 42 sacrifices. Shelo lishma. Right? 7 mizbechos, and not 42, but... 7 mizbechos, and 3 times, right, 42. What? Yeah, it could be. But the Gemara says 42. That he brought them what's it called, Shelo L'shem Shamayim. What does that mean? L'chori brought them in order to destroy Klal Yisrael. That's not L'shelo L'shema, but it just wasn't. Nobody had any tainas on Balak. Balak had a legitimate feeling of being threatened. Jewish people were coming. And he didn't know, you know, he wasn't a big Talmud Chacham, that he knew that we weren't allowed to take his land. And he had a reasonable and justified fear that we would do to him what we did to Sichon and Og. And he hired somebody to prevent that. A person has a right to defend themselves. Self-defense. And he didn't go to Avodah Zarah. He brought sacrifices to the Rabbanu Shlom. But that's called Shelo Lishma. Because he didn't do it altruistically. He did it for a gain. For a personal gain. Because he wanted to benefit and not to be decimated by the Jewish people. So that's called Shelo Lishma. From there, it set in motion spiritual powers that later on came out that Shlomo HaMelech came from his descendants. Through Rus. And Shlomo HaMelech brought alfim, alfei korbanos, thousands of korbanos on the Mizbeach of the Rabbanu Shalom. And Chazal connect the two. That mito shelo lishma bo lishma. You see that if you set spiritual powers in motion, even shelo lishma, eventually they'll come out lishma. So for that, Balak gets a parasha too. Because not everybody can be a Pinchas, and not everybody can be a Sari Menu. Right, or even a Yisro, right? But Lamaisa, people can do things, even if Shelo Lishma, and it has an effect. And eventually, it doesn't mean it'll come necessarily from him that it'll come the Lishma. From Balak, it never came Lishma. But you put a spiritual power into the world, it'll have an effect. Similar to that, Chazal say, that Machshava Tova Kodesh Baruch Hu Metzarfo Lamaisa. Now we normally understand that Chazal in the following way. If a person has a good intent, I want to give tzedakah, okay? I intend to give tzedakah to somebody, and I go broke. I can't do it. Or the person I want to give tzedakah to dies, or wins the lottery, becomes rich, so I can't give him tzedakah anymore. I had a great idea, great intention, I really meant it, but I was prevented by circumstances beyond my control to fulfill my action. So, normally we learn, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers it like you did it, that by a mitzvah, by Averis, by Jews, God, if you wanted to do an Avera and you were stopped. I wanted to murder somebody. Okay? And I made all the plans or whatever, and then something happened beyond my control to stop me. Right? The guy dropped dead. Can't murder him anymore. Right? Whatever, the guns, misfired. So there, machshava ra ein hakadosh baruch hu mitzar. Bad intentions, the Rabbanu Shem does not consider as if you did it, But good intentions, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by a Jew, considers if you did it. That's how normally it's translated. But that's not what it says. It doesn't say, Machshava Tova HaKadosh Baruch Hu Machshivo Kemaisa. Okay, and he considers it like you did it. Right? It says, Mitzarfo Lemaisa. What does that mean? So what I think it means is the following. And I'll tell you first the story, then I'll tell you the Maral Diskin, which I think we've mentioned in the past, but it fits in with this idea, and then how it applies over here. Before my Rosh Yeshiva, one of my Rosh Yeshiva, Boris Sorotskin, was Nifter, he had a terrible mortal illness, and the last 2 weeks of his life were really like touch and go. So his wife was the principal of the girls' high school in Cleveland, Yavna High School. The girls came to her and said, we know that your husband is in critical condition, and we would like to volunteer to say Tehillim around the clock in Mishmarot. Right? In, what's it called in English?
Shifts.
So they did that for 2 weeks. 2 weeks straight, 24 hours a day, there were girls saying Tehillim. And then he died. So during Shiva, she called the girls together, and she said, you probably feel that your tefillos went unanswered, that they didn't accomplish anything, because my husband didn't survive. But let me tell you, your tefillos are a power in the world that didn't go for no use. It's just that it didn't achieve what we would have liked it to achieve. But it's there. Who knows who else perhaps those tefillos helped for? Right? Who knows if it's not helping for my husband's neshama? I thought it would help to keep him alive. Maybe it's helping his neshama in the next world. But no tefillah is ever lost. It's there. It's a power. You created that energy. The energy will be used for something. The Maril Diskin says this idea. He asked a question. He said, Avraham Avinu said tremendous tefillahs for Sdom. If they're 50 tzaddikim, 40 tzaddikim, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. The Rabban Shalom knew where he was going. He knew that there weren't even 10 tzaddikim in Sdom. God wasn't going to go check. Okay, Avraham, I'll go check and see. Right? Obviously, here he came to the decision to destroy Sdom. God knew exactly how many tzaddikim there were, how many there were necessary, and it was a lost cause. So says the Maral Diskin, why didn't the Rabban Shalom stop Avraham Avinu from wasting his time? Avraham Avinu had a lot better things to do than daven for a lost cause. Why didn't he stop him and tell him, Avraham, look, I've researched the topic, right? There aren't enough tzaddikim in the city, so do something else, right? Spend your time in a better way. Don't waste your time davening. Why didn't he stop him? Says the Maral Diskin, because Klal Yisrael needed those tefillahs. Avraham Avinu created a energy source for all generations from those tefillahs. They didn't help for Sodom, but they're a power that exists in the world. That power now can be attached to other things and have other things that will come from it. That's what it means. Machshava tova kodesh baruch mitzarfa lemaisa. I had a good intention. I wanted to give tzedakah. I couldn't do it, right? The guy wanted to give the tzedakah to, won the lottery and became a multimillionaire. So that's the end of my good intention to give that guy tzedakah. Can't do it. Kodesh Baruch Hu takes that good intention. Somebody else wants to do something, but he doesn't have such great intentions. So he doesn't have the power to see it through. The Rabban Hashem takes my machshava tova and mitzarfo lemaisa. He connects it to somebody else's maisa, and from that comes a complete maisa. That's the idea. You do something, it has a power. You do something l'shem shamayim, it will have an effect. It may not have the effect that you think it's going to have, but it'll have an effect. Some way it'll have an effect. And that is the idea, the same thing over here. You do something, even if it's not l'shem shamayim, but it starts the ball rolling. It has some kind of effect. It's there. What's going to happen from it? Eventually it'll cause something that'll be l'shem shamayim. So by Balak it didn't come to that, but it left in nature, it left in the universe a power that later on caused events that eventually would come to thousands of karbonos that were brought to Shem Shemayim. But where did the beginning energy source come from? it wasn't necessarily the full energy source, but it was something. From that will come something else. You always need a little bit. It used to be, I don't think in cars today it's like that, but they used to have a starter motor that would turn over the bigger motor. When you turned the ignition, so there wasn't enough power in the 12-volt battery to turn over that big motor. So what you had is a little starter motor, and the starter motor was able to turn up. But when you turned the key, you only turned that starter motor is no big deal. You couldn't go anywhere with the starter motor. Right? If you had that, you probably could ride a scooter, maybe. I don't know what it could do, the cloud could do. But that little bit of power already, what's it called, was able to trigger something else that was much bigger than it. So same thing, maisim, little maisim. Sometimes you don't have l'shem shamayim. You think that what you did was useless. It wasn't all that perfect or whatever. But you never know what you set in motion that may build on your beginning energy, and because of that, other things will be done that will take advantage of that little bit of energy and turn out to be tremendous things. Especially when it comes to generations. You never know how a maisa in this generation may sprout into something in the next generation or three generations that if you hadn't done this, it wouldn't have enabled your children or grandchildren to do something even a much more grander way. Okay. So that, I think, is why the parsha Balak deserves to have a parsha name for him. Because a maisa, he did something out of self-defense, which he Lechora had a right to do, and he did it l'shem shamayim. In other words, he did it to the Rabban Shalom, not for Avodah Zarah. He could have done it to Avodah Zarah. He brought sacrifices to God. So for that, he was, what's it called? He was Zolche, to have a parsha name for him. Okay. It says, there's an Ibn Ezra that asked the following question. He says, and we're going to give him two answers to this, his answer and a different answer too. He asks, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never harm me, right? What in the world would it have hurt if God just let Bilaam go on his merry way and curse the Jewish people? Who cares? Right? The curse can't hurt anybody if God doesn't want it to hurt them. So why did God have to make this whole thing? First tell him don't go, then tell him what's it called? If you're going, you're going to say what I say. And he had to change the curse into a blessing. Forget about the guy. Ignore him. What could he do? Right? He's an imposter. What could he do? So let him give all the curses he wants in the world, and nothing's going to come from it. So what was the big deal over here? That God had to intervene and make sure that he gave brachas and didn't give curses? So in a little while, I'll tell you what the Tzelzer Rosh Yeshiva says in Shuri Das. But I'll tell you first what the Ibn Ezra says. The Ibn Ezra says that the Rabban Shom knew. And don't get bogged down in this, right? If God knew, then they didn't have free choice. That's not for now, okay? But God knew that there was going to be a sin of Baal Peor. Right? He saw that very soon 22,000 Jews are going to perish because of the immorality that they committed, okay, by Baal Peor. And God was afraid that if he let Bilaam curse the Jewish people, and then later on, 22,000 people died. People would say, you know why they died? Because Bilaam cursed them. Not because they were immoral, but because Bilaam cursed them. And that God didn't want. So he didn't want the association between Bilaam's curse and the 22,000 people dying. Now, when I first saw that Ibn Ezra, it didn't make any sense to me. Right? Because, I don't know, if someone would think, right, that somebody died, okay, there was this person people thought was a tzaddik, okay? And they see the Rahman al-Itzlan, he had a terrible car accident and he was killed, okay? And you have a choice why he was killed. Either because somebody cursed him, just like this, right? Or because he secretly was very immoral and he died because of his immorality, okay? If you were that tzaddik, right, or that apparent tzaddik, okay? What would you rather have? People think that you died because of a curse, or people think you died because you were immoral? No? The curse, no? Because it's a big embarrassment to be immoral, but if somebody cursed me, look, what can I do? It's not my fault. So it's just the opposite. I would say that wouldn't it be better for people to think that 22,000 Jews died because Bilaam cursed them, then the world should know that 22,000 Jews were immoral, and that's why they died? No? Do you think it's a good question? I don't know, it seems to me like it's simple that it should be that way. Now the answer, I think, is the following. That, what's a curse? How does curses work? Right? What did Bilaam want to do? What's the mechanism of a curse? So a curse is the opposite of a bracha. A bracha is an increase. You can't ain habracha, right? You can't have a bracha on nothing. A bracha has to start with something. When Elisha wanted to give the woman extra oil, she had to start with one thing of oil that he could increase. Bracha means to increase. Comes from the word brecha, from a spring that constantly is increasing. What a bracha does is take something and increases it, intensifies it, strengthens it. Okay, that's what a bracha is. You have to start with something, and then you can increase it. But if you have nothing, right, a million times zero is still zero. So you can't start with nothing, start with something. What's a klala? Just the opposite. A klala decreases, weakens. You find a weakness, and you increase the weakness, right? It's increasing a negative. Increasing a negative equals a negative. So if you have a certain deficiency, and you give it a klala, you increase that deficiency. And by increasing the deficiency, you make it more negative. Okay? And because it's more negative, it has a more devastating effect. So just like a bracha has a good effect, a klala has a bad effect. But it's taking a deficiency and intensifying it and increasing it. Okay. In order for a klala to take effect, the deficiency has to be something essential to the thing that you're cursing, right? All the curses that were given in the Torah that took effect were curses on the essence of something that a person represented. Cham got a klala. It was something in his essence that Noah was bringing out to show that this weakness, this deficiency, right, if we don't increase it and make it clear, people are going to have negative results from having something to do with Chom. This way you'll see what he is, stay away from him. Or stay away from him in this area. So a klala means to make something light, kal, but do it by increasing the deficiency. But there has to be a deficiency. And it can't be just a superficial thing, because then the klala won't take effect. Right? Just like a bracha increases something that's essential. Bilaam went to find a deficiency in the essence of the Jewish people. The essence of the Jewish people. Okay? And that's why, okay, he brought sacrifices, seven sacrifices on seven mizbechos, a par of a aisle. What was missing? The keves. Always we parim, elim, and kvasim. It was only par and aisle. All through the Midrashim, whenever parim are brought, zekeneged Avram. Avram Avinu is the par is a symbol of Avram Avinu, right? The aisle is a symbol of Yitzchak, obviously, right? The aisle instead of Yitzchak, right? And the keves is a symbol of Yaakov Avinu. Bilaam knew that he couldn't deal with the Jewish people as they were because God chose them or whatever, but he had to look to find a deficiency in their roots, in their roots. So he looked to the roots of Avram and Yitzchak. Now, Avram seemingly had some deficiency, two reasons. One, he came from Terach, who was not from the greater personalities of this world, even though he did tshuva before he died. But he came from him before he did tshuva. And he had a son called Yishmael, who was also not one of the greater personalities in the world until he did tshuva. But both of them seemed to show there was something about Avram Avinu that was deficient. So he brought seven sacrifices, parim, seven represents perfection, and he wanted to bring out from that there's something imperfect about their sources. And that's where he started his bracha. Ki meirosh suri marenu, I see him from the avos and imahos, and lohibit oven biyakov. God does not look at their sins, but he sees essentially the sins are all superficial. They're all not what they are, but what they do. This is not the essence of the Jewish people. Bilaam could not find a deficiency in the roots of the Jewish people, and therefore he couldn't curse them. he was forced to give a bracha. Had he found that deficiency, and then God's anger, he would have been able to attach the anger to the deficiency, then it could have been, the klala could have come out. Therefore, when God was concerned, says the Ibn Ezra, that people would think that Bilaam's curse took effect. That would mean that there's something intrinsically, essentially deficient in the Jewish people that can be cursed. And if that's the case, then the Jewish people, why did God choose them? Why did God choose them, deficient people? But if they died because they're immoral, nobody said the Jews are perfect. We can do terrible things and we can be punished for terrible things we do. But we are not, in essence, deficient. Only deficient in what we do superficially, our actions. Right? Similar to in last week's Sedra, which we mentioned, I think, last year, Moshe Rabbeinu was punished for calling the Jewish people Morim. Shimu no ha-Morim. Yet the same Moshe Rabbeinu said later on, Mamrim ha-Yisim im Hashem, you're rebellious against God. Why is that not worse than Shimu no ha-Morim? Here he says, Mamrim ha-Yisim Hashem miyon darti eskem. You rebelled against God for the time I knew you. So if he was punished already, he couldn't go into Eretz Yisrael because he called them Morim. How did he repeat the sin? And here he wasn't punished again because he said, Mamrim ha-Yisim. So we quoted the Reb Shlomo Astruck, who was a Talmud of the Rashba. He wrote a Sefer Midrashi HaTorah. And he says the answer is, there's a very significant difference between calling people Morim or Mamrim HaYisim Mashem. The example I always like to give is, you have a little child, right? Let's use a girl because we want to have equality over here. And little girls steal too, not only little boys. So you have your little daughter, she's 5 years old, and she sees that, you know, you go to the store, you take out this colored paper, and they give you things for it. Right? And, she would like some too, but she doesn't know where to get it. Then she sees, now she knows where the colored paper comes from. Her mother's pocketbook. That's where the colored paper is kept. So one day, when her mother's sleeping, she goes into her mother's pocketbook and takes out some colored paper and goes to the store. It happens. It happens in the best of families, okay? And she didn't realize she did anything wrong per se, but you have to teach that child that that's called stealing. So you call your little daughter in, 5 years old, right? You find out that she's walking around with a few hundred shekel bills. Where'd she get them or whatever? Obviously she didn't earn them anywhere, right? And she admits, yeah, it took them, and you see in your pocketbook you're missing a few hundred shekel, right? You put two and two together. Where'd you get those? I took it from mommy's pocketbook. So now you can react in one of two ways. You can say, Mamali, you're a ganav. You're a thief. You stole from my pocketbook. Don't steal again, you're a thief. Or you can say, Mamali, you're a little, nice little girl, right? But you did something terrible, you stole. What's the difference between the two? Difference is, have you labeled that child? If you tell the child you're a thief, then it hits that child in their subconscious that they're a thief. My parents called me a ganav. Then you'll find out what did God know of him do? Steal. So my parents said I'm a thief, and therefore it'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy. She'll live up to the fact that she's a thief, so she has to continue stealing, because thieves steal. You branded her, you labeled her. But if you tell her, no, you're a sweet, beautiful little child, but you did something terrible, you stole, and stealing is a terrible thing, then you're only labeling her action, not her, who she is. And then it's just not a self-fulfilling prophecy. She'll stop stealing. Right? She knows stealing is something wrong, and it's not tsukapas for her. It's not befitting her to steal. She's not a ganav. So that's the difference. When Moshe Rabbeinu said, Mamrim ha'yisim Hashem, you were rebellious against God, he was describing what they did. What they did, you can give it to them. But when you call them Shimun ha-Morim, you are rebels, you're branding them, you're labeling them. And that's a lack of belief in God. Yan lo hemantem bi, why? Because God chose us. If he thought we're a bunch of rebels, would he choose us? Either he doesn't know who we are, or he doesn't have any idea who to choose. So I don't believe in God. But if God chose us, it must be that he knows that we're fit to be chosen. We do terrible things, but in essence, we're good people. In essence, we're pure and holy. Klal Yisrael can do terrible things and even get punished and even be in danger of being destroyed? Yeah. But that's because what we do, not what we are. What we are, the essence of the Jewish people is pure and holy. So therefore, says the Ibn Ezra, God did not want to give the impression that the Jewish people were vulnerable to a curse, and 22,000 Jews died because of a curse. Because if they die because of a curse, that it means there's something intrinsically, essentially wrong with us that the curse could take effect on. And that's much worse than saying Jews can be immoral. Yeah, Jews can be immoral. Jews can do terrible things. Jews can be murderers, and Jews can be thieves, and they can be even worse than Goyim sometimes. When they fall, they're worse than the Goyim. But that's what they do. It's not what they are. In essence, a Jew is a Jew. That's the difference. That's one answer. Right? Yeah.
But once again, when I ask the story, the only reason why that happened, Bill, because he failed at cursing them, he said, you know what, a last resort, I'm going to give them this advice, they should fall victim to the immorality. If he would have succeeded in the curses, he wouldn't have given them that, they would have done it.
No, and Hanami, yes or no, but what it could be is that's exactly the moral of the story. Bilam said, I can't attack their essence. So the most we can do is get them to sin superficially. Right? And that, you want them punished? I'll get them punished for you. But if you want me to reveal an essential deficiency in the Jewish people, I can't do that. That's exactly what he, as a last resort, he said, I can't do what you asked me to do. I can't get at their essence. Right, I can't, you know, plant a bacteria in their essence. The most I can do is give them something superficial on the outside. The Shurei Das is a completely different idea. And for that, you have to really understand the workings of the world. We see a world where we see cause and effect in nature. Right? Physical world, okay? And cause and effect is a pretty strong thing, right? God created a natural world, and he wants the world to function naturally, and if that natural order is disrupted, we call that a miracle. And miracles don't happen so easily, because God wants the world to function naturally. If God intervenes and makes a miracle, it's a big deal, right? Meaning, if somebody drops an atomic bomb on a city, okay, and it doesn't go off, not only doesn't it go off, but it explodes and colored water comes out, right, and bathes everybody in perfumed colored water instead of annihilating the city. That would be a tremendous miracle, no? Right? Everybody would talk about it for the next 100 years, at least, okay? If it was clear that this was an atomic bomb that should have exploded, should have, annihilated the entire city, and the whole process of nature changed, and instead of the fission, fusion, whatever an atomic bomb is, right, colored water sprout from the thing, okay? People wouldn't stop talking about it. We don't realize that the physical world that we see with its causes and effects is just the tip of the iceberg. But there's spiritual forces that are behind all of that, right? And that are just as real, if not more real, than the physical forces. Because the spiritual force is eternal. Physical force is only for this world. So therefore, there are forces in nature, that spiritual nature, that also have the same effect. Just as much as if I make a gun, and I put a bullet in the chamber, and I pull the trigger, and the pin hits the charge, and the bullet's supposed to go, right? And that doesn't happen miraculously, it's a miracle. If you know how to make a curse, there is a force in nature called a curse. It works. It works. Right? As long as you know how to do it. There are spiritual forces in nature that cause many, many things. Magic. Right? According to most Rishonim, the Rambam excluded. But according to most Rishonim, the magicians in Egypt knew how to manipulate spiritual forces, and they could actually do things with their magic. It wasn't just sleight of hand. Right? It wouldn't just look like that. It was real. They could really turn sticks into snakes. They could do it. How? I don't know. But the alchemists, right, were looking for a way to turn metal into gold, right? We could do that today. It's very expensive to do. All you have to do is bombard the metal with enough electrons to change atomic weight of the thing, right, and change it into another material. You can do it. So they didn't know how to do it physically, they knew how to do it with spiritual forces. But there are spiritual forces. That does not mean, right, that today somebody can do that. Because we've lost to a certain degree the knowledge of those spiritual forces. But people back then, big people like Bilam, knew how to control these spiritual forces. They knew how to manipulate the forces of nature and come out with a curse. And if they cursed, right, it wasn't just a curse, you know, curse you, or whatever. It wasn't so simple. There was whole things you had to do. That's why they'd bring the sacrifices, and there was a whole mechanism how to do it, right? But if you knew how to do it, you could set into motion very negative powers against somebody, and it has an effect. It has an effect. So if God prevented Balaam from making that atomic bomb, and instead of an atomic bomb, an explosion, came colored water that was soothing and a bracha, that's no less a miracle than the atomic bomb miracle. That's why it says in the Navi and Micha, remember what God did for you, right? How he changed the klal of Balaam to bracha. What's the big deal? He did for us. What did Balaam have? But if God would have said, remember what God did for you, he changed the atomic bomb that Balaam threw on you to fountains of water, that would have been really something. It's exactly the same thing, if not more. Because Balaam knew how to make these things. That doesn't mean there are people today who know how to do these things or whatever. There's a lot of spiritual forces in the world that we're not anymore, we don't know how to control them or whatever. There's people who claim they know something about it, and that's very dangerous. There's all these alternative medicines that are alternative medicines with spiritual forces, Reiki and other kinds of things. You have to know which ones are kosher and which ones are not. But there are ones that manipulate forces that you're not allowed to manipulate. And it could be that there are forces like that, and there is something to it. But you know what it's like? I always like to give the marshal like this. Imagine a person comes from deepest Africa, right? Never saw electricity. And somebody shows him that you can turn a switch on the wall and the lights go on. He says, wow, this is really something. I mean, back at home, you know, we make fires and can't keep that in the house too much, right? Burn down your house. But if I could do this, put the fire on the thing and make light with, I'll be a millionaire. Right? I'll sell this, right? No, who wouldn't buy it? So he goes to the home center and he buys 100 switch plates and switches and 100 bulbs, right, and fixtures, and he goes back to deepest Africa, and he calls his tribe together, and he says, I want to show you something that you're not going to believe this. And he attaches the fixtures to the ceiling like it is over here, screws in the bulbs, nails the switch plate and the switches to the wall, and he says, you got to see this, watch this. Switches a switch, nothing happens. He says, they took advantage of me. They thought I was some, you know, what's it called, ignorant African, and they sold me defective stuff. Takes all the stuff back, goes back to home center, and he says, all these things, the switches are defective and the bulbs are defective, nothing works. They said, did you check your fuse box? What fuse box? Did you check the intake of the house, of the electricity? What electricity? There's a switch, there's a bulb, there's fixtures, that's what I see. Doesn't work. Obviously, there's a lot behind the scenes that if you don't know about it, you could have all the switch plates and switches and bulbs and fixtures. It's not going to ever work because the main thing is missing. So today, people may know the lights and the thing, but they don't know all the workings. Therefore, at worst, it won't work. At best, it won't work. At worst, you know what will happen? They finally find that there's wires. And they'll find that they have to hook it up to an electric source, but they don't have any idea how to do it. So they'll set it up in a way that either they'll be electrocuted when they turn the switch, or they'll electrocute somebody else and it'll burn down a house. So if you don't know all the workings, you're not an electrician, right, and you start dabbling with things that you don't really know all the powers of them, you're really dealing with a very dangerous situation. So today, there are people who maybe have vestiges of these spiritual powers, but they're what's it called? They don't know really how to put them together properly, and that's very dangerous. But they exist. And therefore, the Rabbanu Shalom, it wasn't a question of, well, you know, sticks and stones can break. That's not true. If you know how to manipulate spiritual powers, you can create a spiritual atomic bomb and cause havoc. And if God doesn't let you do it, and he makes the opposite from what really should have been an atomic bomb, comes fountains of water, that's a miracle. That's the same exact miracle. That's what the Shurei Das says. So we have two different answers, one more of a Musar answer, one more of a esoteric answer, but those are the two answers. Okay, let's see. One more thing. Okay, there's one more thing. The Svarno asks a question. He said, we know that Bilam had a power to curse, like we explained. He knew when God was angry, he could direct that anger. He knew how to manipulate the spiritual forces to create curses. But we never find anywhere that Bilam had the power to bless anybody. He knew how to curse people, okay? Nowhere does it say that he knew how to bless people. Because if he knew how to bless people, why did Balak hire him to curse the Jewish people? Why didn't he hire him to bless him? Must be. He knew that he didn't have that power. He had a bad eye, right? He only had one eye, in fact. And that one eye, he was able to really direct, really evil eye. There was a guy in the comics, used to be that guy with in Little Abner, was that what it was? Yeah. Not Evil Knievel, but Evil something or other. But in any case, so that's what he had the power, right? To give a whammy to, he didn't have the power to bless anybody. So why, when Balak invited him, he said to him the following, ki yodati, because everybody knows, es asher tevorech mevorach, whoever you bless is blessed, v'asher to'or you are, and whoever you curse is cursed. But if he thought he could bless people, why didn't he ask them to bless him? Why didn't he come to curse them? Says the Svarno, he says like this, he says, Balak knew that Bilam had no power to bless anybody. But he felt it just wasn't bakovid for Bilam to say, for Balak to say about Bilam, I know you're such a negative person, you can curse anybody you want. So out of honor, right, and respect for Bilam, he added in what he knew wasn't true. Oh, you could bless people, you could curse people. Just to say about somebody, you could curse people, is really not nice, right, to make them such a negative people. Today, right, people, you know, pride themselves that they can be critical people, you know, and I really gave it to him, I put him down or whatever, and people, like, you know, look up to people like that. Ah, wow, negative people, right? Watch out for that guy because he can really put you down. Right? And even Lahavdil and yeshivas, you know, and amongst respectable people, sometimes people who can, you know, really give it to somebody, you know, really, they're looked up to, right? They're, you know, somebody special. He could really give it to somebody. But if it's a bizoyan, it's disrespectful to a Bilam to say that he's a negative person. How much more so is it disrespectful to anybody to be a negative person? Right? People who can only look bad at people and curse and criticize, it's not a positive thing. It's a positive thing to be positive, not to be a negative person. So if Bilam would have been insulted to be called a negative person, everybody should be insulted to be called a negative person. It shouldn't be something that people laud people for or brag about, that I'm such a negative person or whatever and I can really put people down. So that's, I think, a lesson from that Svarno. And that's why people who are overly critical and can't, what's the word I'm looking for? They're not accepting, understanding. What's the word for that? What? Yeah, that's in Yiddish. But what's the English for that? They can't, tolerant. That's it. Thank you. Tolerance. They're intolerant people, right? Can't say anything good about it. They can't tolerate anything that, you know, beyond, not less, less than their standards. That's not a positive thing. It's a very negative thing. And it doesn't come because people are great people. It comes because people aren't great enough. How do I learn that? And we'll end with this. The famous Maisa with Shimon Bar Yochai and his son, Reb Elezer. We're in a cave, right? Running away from the government, the Roman government who wanted to kill them, so they hid away in a cave. For 12 years, they ate charuvim, right, boxer, which grew up miraculously. They had a spring of water, and the whole day they learned Torah. They didn't even wear their clothes, as you wear out. They buried themselves in the sand till the waist and learned Torah, right? They didn't even daven. They learned constantly, okay? And they were on such a high level that finally they were able to leave the cave. The people that were after them died. They were what's it called, able to leave the cave. They came out of the cave and they saw people planting, plowing, going to work. They said, how in the world can people waste their time with Chai Yishua and not sit and learn all the time? What in the world are you wasting your time? You're wasting your Olam Haba. And wherever they looked, got burnt up. So a bas kol came out of the Shemayim and it said, I didn't let you out of the cave to destroy my world. Get back in the cave. So they went back in the cave for another year. They come out. Reb Shem Bar Yochai, what's it called? Reb Elezer is still burning up every place. And Reb Shem Bar Yochai, wherever Reb Elezer burns, he looks and he heals it. So two things bother me. If I would ask you, why were Reb Shem Bar Yochai and Reb Elezer so intolerant of people on such a low level, lower level than them? People are just working, right? They couldn't tolerate it, right? We sat for 12 years. All we had to do is learn. But if you learn, so a buckshot tree will grow, and you'll get water. What do you need to work? What are you wasting your time? Why were they so intolerant? Because for 12 years they were in a cave, separated from the world on such a high level. So what in the world's going to help to send him back to the cave for another year? It's going to make the problem worse, no? Send him to Miami for a year, I guarantee. That will mellow them out or whatever, right? They won't be so critical anymore, okay? Send him to Las Vegas. Don't send him back to the cave. If anything, you're exasperating the situation, no? So why do you send him back to the cave? Second question is, okay, now they both come out again, and Reb Elezer is still burning up. Send him back to the cave. Why do you let him out now? The answer is like this. The answer to the first question is, what I see from here is, that people are intolerant and critical, not because they know too much, because they don't know enough. The people who really know, who really reach, know how to look and see everything in its proper perspective. People who are not yet there, not yet fully ripe in their learning, are very intolerant. The more the godly a person is, the more tolerant he is. And the less tolerant means he's not yet reached that point. That's usually the case. So therefore, sending him back another year to the cave will help. Not only that, but you need both. You need to be critical. You can't just have a rosy, everything is okay, everybody's okay, no criticism. So usually it's the young people that are more critical, you know, the more kanoim. And they get older, you get more mellow, and yeah, you can understand already more, and look at the world in a much more accepting way. So you need the shutvus, you need the partnership. You need the young guy who's criticizing, but as long as he has the father there who can heal it and make it constructive criticism, that's fine. But if you have only the old people who everything is okay and nothing is critical, and only the young people who everything is critical, if you have both eyes critical or both eyes too tolerant, that's no good. But if you have one eye like this and one eye like that, fine. Bilaam's problem was he only had one eye. He only had that critical eye. And he didn't have the other eye to balance it out. So therefore, that was the negative person that he was.